The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. On today's show, I'll be flying solo. That's because Jim's traveling today. I apologize, I wasn't paying enough attention when he told me where he was going to share it with you all. All I know is he's in the act of traveling somewhere by plane today. So we decided to do what we do occasionally when I'm alone on the show, and that is to get caught up on our pile of Social Security questions. We always have a multitude of those questions that have come into the show, and we answer a couple every show, but that we don't stay ahead of it. So this gives us a chance to get at least a little bit caught up. So the show will be a little tighter than normal, no bantering, etc. Bantering with myself just causes my family to question what I'm doing in the recording studio. But I'll try to make it as exciting as possible, although I am going to do the whole show with my shirt on. If you've been listening to the shows lately, Jim's been having this crackpot idea to spice things up by pretending we're doing the show with less than normal amount of clothes on. So I'm fully clothed during this show. So you'll just have to deal with that. I've got, I think, five questions or so. If the questions have a hint as to the state of origin of the podcast listener that sent this in, I will let you all play along. Obviously, I have the questions in front of me, so I'll have the answers, but I know some of you like to play along. So I'll read them when I have them. This first one doesn't look like it's got one, but sometimes they surprise me as I read through it. This is a fairly long email. So this one came in here just a few months ago, actually. And it starts, "Good afternoon, Jim." I'm going to take it since I'm the Social Security guy. So I've been an avid listener to the Retirement and IRA Show for a few years now and have really enjoyed it. I have a question that I have asked two different representatives of Social Security, and I received two different answers, which I find concerning. I am widowed, but have also worked my entire life as a healthcare worker for a major hospital in Beantown. That's your hint on where I am from. So there you go. There is a little embedded trivia question in here. I unexpectedly had to go out on long-term disability due to multiple hand surgeries and was no longer able to perform my job that I had dedicated my career to for over 40 years. Luckily, I'd been paying for long-term disability policy through my employer for many years and was grateful to have the regular paycheck as I'm the only breadwinner in my family. Part of my LTD, long-term disability policy, required me to apply for Social Security disability on my own record. So let me pause there for a second. Let me emphasize this listener is talking about a long-term disability policy, not a long-term care policy. many people get those two things confused. The most common confusion I see is people have a long-term disability policy, usually through their work, and they think it's long-term care policy. Those are two very different things. Long-term disability is to pay you when you can't go to work when you otherwise would be going to work. It usually stops when you reach normal retirement age, most cases 65 years old. It's not for long-term care, which is when you're getting older and then you're failing to do two of six activities of daily living, or you have cognitive decline, so you're a danger to yourself or to others. And so just be clear, if you have one of these policies, know what it does, what it doesn't do. So this policy is to pay, replace the paycheck to a certain percent if you were to become disabled and unable to do your job, which is what this particular person had. And I'll also point out that their comment that they finished with before I interrupted the email here, where it says, part of my LTD policy requires me to apply for Social Security disability on my own record. That's a typical part of these policies where they want to essentially become the secondary insurer. And if you're truly disabled and can qualify for Social Security disability, which is generally a higher threshold of qualification, but they want you to at least apply, because if you can get Social Security disability, then they only pay the difference between the Social Security disability and what the policy benefits promise. So it's in their best interest, but to continue paying you, they require that you apply. They will still pay you if you get declined by Social Security, but they want you to go through the act of applying, and that's a prerequisite essentially for them paying you. So getting back to the email, they say, I applied, and to my surprise, I was approved the first time out. I've heard it usually takes multiple times to get approved for Social Security disability. That is true. Although there is a list of afflictions that you can have where you get approved very quickly and somewhat automatically, and depending on your medical records that get submitted as part of the application, sometimes it does happen exactly like they're describing here, where it just gets approved, then you don't have to go through the long and tedious appeal process. This is my question. I was 62 when I was approved. I'm now 65 years old. My full retirement age for Social Security is 66 and 8 months. I was told by the first Social Security representative I no longer have the option to collect a survivor benefit on my husband's record, and once full retirement age, I will just switch over from SSDI, that Social Security disability, on my own record to my regular Social Security retirement benefit on my own record. They did tell me I could suspend my benefits until 70, therefore increasing my monthly benefits, but would not receive any payments in the interim. The second representative told me I should contact Social Security 4 or 5 months before my full retirement age of 66 and 8 months and tell them I want to stop my payments of SSDI before it switches over to my regular payments, then apply for survivor benefits based on my late husband's record, therefore leaving my own to increase until age 70. I'm not sure what is true, but obviously this makes a big financial difference for me moving forward, and I don't want to make a mistake. I feel like I'm being penalized for having to take Social Security disability payments on my own record and losing out on my survivor benefits to eventually have a larger delayed benefit of my own record, or on my own record. Appreciate any clarification on this predicament. It really makes a difference to a widow or widower. Okay, so first I want to say that it's unfortunately fairly common to get multiple answers, sometimes seemingly conflicting answers, from the Social Security representatives when you ask them questions. Social Security is a complex program, and there are a lot of exceptions and rules that sometimes change and surprise people. And so what I usually recommend, if you have conflicting answers or an answer maybe that you don't agree with because you've done some research or heard it discussed or described a different way, if you have a question, you can always ask for what's called a technical expert to take a look at the situation and give you a more authoritative answer. That increases the likelihood that you'll get the, quote, correct answer, but doesn't also guarantee it. I've seen technical experts at times give incorrect answers until pressed, and then they did some research and got it corrected. I've never seen where there wasn't eventually a resolution when there was seemingly bad advice or bad information being provided by Social Security. So that's a general statement. And this is one that, because of the nuances of how things work, I could see how it could be interpreted a couple of different ways. Let me also say or describe what they're feeling like they're missing out on. And when you file, well, let me step back. When you lose a spouse and you have not yet claimed any benefits, you actually still retain a strategy that's at your disposal to claim one and then switch to the other. And the original claiming of the first benefit doesn't affect the ultimate claiming of the second. So this creates a situation where a lot of widows or widowers, I'll call them survivors generally, for survivors who have lost their spouses, if they haven't yet claimed any Social Security, oftentimes they'll claim a survivor benefit first, leaving their own benefit to grow to as late as age 70, earning delayed retirement credits, which don't get granted to survivor benefits. Survivor benefits don't grow after the person who passed away earned any of their own credits. There are credits available to them, but they stop. No further delayed retirement credits can be earned by the survivor by waiting. But their own benefit could grow. So normally when you wait to earn delayed retirement credits, you pay a price that's pretty hefty, and that price is you don't get any benefits until you turn on the larger benefit later. But when you have a survivor benefit available, you could claim the survivor benefit first, leaving your own till 70, and then when you reach 70, switch over to your own. We call it in the office getting paid to wait instead of waiting while getting nothing. However, what's gone away is the ability to collect any benefits, auxiliary benefits, while your own benefit is in suspension. So suspension means you've claimed your benefit, you say your retirement benefit, and then at any time after reaching full retirement age, you decide for some reason you want to stop the benefit, pause it, if you will, you can suspend your benefit, and they will put you in suspension, won't pay you. And if you're between full retirement age and 70, they will start crediting you with delayed retirement credits during that time. And then you could unpause when you reached age 70. However, while you're in suspension, ever since 2015, when they made some adjustments to the rules, I think it was 2015, might have been 2016, they barred you from collecting any other auxiliary benefits while in suspension. It disrupted a number of strategies for Social Security with these rule changes back then. What that does is it affects your ability to, say, claim your benefit, you then lose your spouse later, and maybe if you hadn't claimed, you would do the strategy I described a moment ago, which is claim the survivor first and then switch to your own. But because you'd already started the clock on your own benefit, you can't access that survivor benefit while your own benefit grows to 70. Because for your benefit to start growing with delayed retirement credits, you'd have to suspend it, and you can now no longer receive any other benefits while in suspension. So that's the unfortunate thing. And that's why we always tell people, if you lose a spouse before you claim your own benefit, reassess your claiming strategy immediately because you have some flexibility. If you've already claimed, there's not a lot of flexibility there because of this new rule. So how it relates to this question, so these two representatives giving different information here, it is true, the nuance here, because they're on Social Security disability, if you didn't know already, I'll share with you that if you're on Social Security disability, that payment or benefit will automatically switch to your own retirement benefit when you reach full retirement age. essentially it's an accounting function at Social Security where they say, we don't have to pay you out of the disability pool anymore because now you're your regular retirement age, so we're just going to pay you your retirement benefit. You're not really disabled in our eyes anymore because you don't need to be going to work anymore. You've reached your full retirement age. So they automatically switch you over to your own benefit. Well, I think you can see where this is going after I described what I did moments ago. You're claiming your own benefit now. The only way to get delayed retirement credits is to suspend it. And I just shared while you're in suspension, you cannot collect other benefits. So the first representative that was said, I no longer have the option to collect survivors and then switch over and do the strategy. That's essentially true. The first person is consistent. Their answer is consistent with the current rules. The second person, I don't know if they misunderstood the rule or if they were trying to create, I'm not sure where they were going with, I know where they were going with this. They appear to have realized that this automatic conversion from disability to retirement happens at full retirement age. And this representative told this listener, hey, to prevent that from happening, call Social Security 4 or 5 months ahead and stop your SSDI payments. Like cancel your disability with the idea, I'm assuming, that then the automatic conversion to your own benefit wouldn't happen and you won't have to worry about this suspension issue. You wouldn't have claimed your retirement benefit yet. Unfortunately, there's no way, to my knowledge, to cancel Social Security disability without withdrawing the original application, which means when you withdraw your application for benefits, you have to pay back all the money that they paid you from the beginning. And you're not going to want to do that. So the one thing that can happen is if you get healthy enough, you become undisabled, like I'm not sure that's the right term, but you know what I mean, and you go back to work. If you're able to work, they will suspend your Social Security disability payments, but they're not stopping them. They're not canceling you in the disability system. They're just recognizing you're at work now, so you don't qualify to receive these benefits. But because you're already receiving SSDI in the system, this conversion to your own benefits at full retirement age is still going to happen. Now, if all that's at stake is your own benefit, it's no big deal because you can still suspend as soon as you reach your full retirement age. So when they would normally convert you automatically, if you don't want to start receiving benefits, if you don't need them, you want to get the delayed retirement credits, you can overcome this automatic conversion through suspending. But the side effect is the new rule bars collecting other auxiliary benefits while you're in suspension, which takes away, and this kind of hits to their comment, I feel like I'm being penalized for having to take Social Security disability payments on my own record and losing out on my survivor benefits to eventually have a larger delayed benefit on my own record. And that's kind of true. Do not have available to you a strategy that you otherwise might because you are in disability and disability works the way I've described. If anyone has successfully done what the second representative has proposed, which is actually somehow terminate or cancel your Social Security right before reaching full retirement age so this automatic conversion doesn't happen, I would love to hear about it. Because that would be the workaround for this penalty. This is a side effect of lawmakers and rulemakers not anticipating some of the rule changes, how they might affect people who aren't trying to scam the system or use a loophole or something. I think they are penalizing a group of survivors unfairly in this because of this automatic conversion feature combined with the new rules about suspension. So if you want from the horse's mouth, do my original recommendation, which is call Social Security again or go back into the office and ask to talk to a technical expert. Every office has one. They'll review your case and give you the what should be more authoritative answer. If you find out that you can do this little loophole, which is cancel somehow your Social Security right before it converts so it doesn't convert, please reach back out to me, because that would be very valuable for any number of widow and widowers out there that are facing this same issue. So thanks a lot for writing. I'm sorry I don't have better info for you. I'm sure it was, you were hoping that the second person, the second representative was correct, but I honestly don't think that they are. So anyway. Okay. Second question here. Let's see here. This one, no hint, I don't think. They're from New Jersey. Oh, by the way, the last one, Beantown's got to be Boston, right? But question number two, a lot shorter here. They're from New Jersey, no hint. My husband and I married in May of 2022. At the time, he was the sole guardian and caregiver of his adult autistic daughter who was collecting Social Security disability and lived with us full time. Jointly, we care for her and provide full parental control. In January of 2023, my husband started collecting retirement benefits, and his daughter started collecting benefits as a disabled adult child, receiving benefits based on his record. Since she was 28 at the time, I never went through the legal adoption process. As a stepmother, do I qualify for child in care spousal benefits, or do you have to be a natural parent or an adoptive parent? Good question. Short answer, and then I'll expand on it, is no, you do not have to be the natural parent or adoptive parent. Child in care spousal benefits you qualify for by being the spouse of the, in this case, the husband, what Social Security affectionately calls the number holder. That's the person, the Social Security number holder, who upon which their earnings record has generated a benefit for themselves and others, in this case, an adult disabled child and a spouse. Normally, spousal benefits are only available if you've done two things. One, be married to someone who's claiming. That box has been checked here because it says in January 23, husband started collecting. And two, you've reached the age of 62 at a minimum. However, child in care spousal waives the second thing. They essentially ignore then the age for two reasons, for eligibility, and also they don't reduce the spousal benefit because you're claiming it before your own full retirement age. So there's two benefits to doing the child in care spousal. And the child in care spousal essentially just means that there is a qualifying child collecting on the husband's record, and that's absolutely happening. And you are the spouse of that husband who has the child in care, and you are helping, you're caring for that spouse, or I'm sorry, caring for that child in your home. You don't have to be yourself directly related to the child. The qualification for you or the eligibility for you comes from being married to the person who's claimed benefits. And then there's this qualifying child also receiving benefits. So no adoption necessary. Boy, there was one other thing I thought I was going to mention. As I sometimes when I'm talking, my brain starts, you know, adding things that I want to make sure to share with you at the end. Oh, the one thing I was going to mention is that the total benefits going into the household may not increase that much. That's the only downside, and that's the reason for that is something called the family maximum. So there's a maximum amount that they will pay on any one number holder's record, regardless of the number of beneficiaries receiving benefits on that record. There's a cap. Right now, you haven't reached the cap because he's receiving benefits, and then his daughter is receiving probably 50% of his PIA. Well, the family maximum is between 150 and 182, 185% of the number holder's PIA. And So when you claim as a spouse, spouses are eligible for up to 50% of the PIA of the number holder, the person who's claiming. Well, if we add it up, if the husband's getting 100%, and by the way, even though he's claiming early, they still, for the family maximum, count his PIA against the family maximum. So he's getting, he represents the 100. Then the question is 50 to 82%. Well, if the child is collecting 50 and you are eligible for 50, that's another 100. You're not going to get 100. The most you're going to get is about 82% and could be as low as 50%, meaning you might claim the child in care spousal and not a single extra dollar flows into the household. It all's going to depend on the calculation of the family maximum for you. And it's a, I'm not going to walk people through it. It would take probably a whole show to explain how it works. It's kind of a tiered system where different amounts of the number holder's PIA, primary insurance amount, are essentially counted towards the family maximum. But bottom line, somewhere between 150 and 182% of the number holders or beneficiaries PIA is the most that can be paid combined to all claimants, I guess we could call them, on the record of the one person, you know, the husband. So good news is you qualify. So that was the thing I wanted to make sure to point out. The bad news is you're not going to maybe get as much as you thought. Maybe as low as zero, but I suspect you're going to get some, because I will say most people's family maximum end up being like 170 to 180%, somewhere in there. So I think you'll get a bit of a bump, but you might only, you know, won't get as much as you thought. And effectively how they do it is they proportionally reduce all of the auxiliary beneficiaries. So the child benefit is going to go down a little bit, and they'll figure out, you know, what's the maximum that can be paid between the two of you, between the child and you, and you'll get half and they'll get half. So the child's benefit will technically go down a little bit, but you'll gain a benefit and it'll come, you know, it'll add together up to the family maximum that's allowed in your particular case. So good news generally, but a little bit of maybe bad news, we'll call it, because of the cap that I'm talking about here. Okay, question number 3 comes in. It's pretty fresh, just from February. The last one I didn't have a date on. I don't know when it came in. This one, there is a quiz. So I'll tell you at the end what the answer is so you can be thinking about it. The quiz itself, the quiz question, we live in a state which has the third longest coastline in all 50 states. I'll reveal the answer at the end. As longtime listeners, my wife and I learned a lot about retirement finances, but you've never talked about the maximum Social Security benefit a couple can earn. My wife and I both made good salaries during our work years, but now that I'm 67 and my wife is 64, it looks like we may hit the maximum of $9,746, that's the number they provided, $9,746, when both of us start collecting Social Security at 70. Can you talk about how to decide what the maximum Social Security benefit would be in 3 to 6 years? Thank you and keep up the great work. First, I'm curious as to why you're asking the question. And the reason is the two of you aren't going to be affected by any arbitrary maximum. So it's not like there's a ceiling you're going to hit other than the natural ceiling we all face, which is there is, in fact, a maximum benefit that you can receive, but it's not because of an arbitrary cap on the benefit. It's because of the somewhat arbitrary cap on the earnings that are counted in your earnings record. For those of you who may not be familiar, in any given year, when you are a wage earner, you're making money to deposit earnings record information into your earnings record at Social Security, which is ultimately going to be used to calculate your benefit. There's only so much of your earnings that actually get counted and taxed, and it's called the maximum wage base. And in 2024, for example, that maximum is $168,600. And every year there's a maximum. Last year it was about $160,000, and it adjusts with wage inflation over time. So the maximum that went into your earnings record 15 years ago would be much lower than 168. But if you pegged it, if you pegged that maximum every year, so if you were a high wage earner, I've run across a number of people that have 35 years in their earnings record. By the way, that's the number of years they use in the calculation for your benefit. They've got 35 years where they blew the top off of the max each year. So they, in the formula, hit and earn the maximum benefit. And it's maximum benefit because the earnings that they count in the calculation have a limit that they count. Even if you earn more than that, they only count up to what they taxed you on. So the 9746 he mentioned is about what the maximum is. So for I know for people turning full retirement age this year, the maximum benefit, the maximum PIA, so the maximum benefit at full retirement age, is like 3825 or something, about 3822 technically. I have a little Social Security cheat sheet on my desk that I keep here. So 3822. Now, when they call it the maximum benefit, that's not the maximum benefit you could actually receive, because you could increase it by delaying to 70 and get 24%+ more, depending on your full retirement age, increase on that number. So that's the maximum is maximum full retirement age benefit, not the maximum you could earn. So if we do that, their numbers, 9746, must take that into consideration. If I take that 3822 and grow it by like 24% or so for someone that has a full retirement age of 67, his is probably more like 66 and 8 months or something like that based on his current age. Then they get right about this number, that 9746. But in 3 to 6 years, inflation is going to happen, and these benefits that they're looking at here are going to be increased for inflation, and there's no cap that keeps that increase from happening. Also, you heard me talk in the last question about this family maximum, where the most that can be paid on any one worker's record is between 150 and 182% of their PIA. Well, that's on that one individual's record. There's no maximum that a couple can earn when they each have their own benefits. Each one will get an unrestricted full benefit of whatever they're eligible to receive based on their earnings record. So if you've got two spouses that had great careers and they pegged the earnings record for 35 years, they're each eligible to receive the maximum they possibly could. There's no arbitrary limit on there. Now, I was assuming that was the question that they were concerned about. Are we going to hit some ceiling and then maybe it doesn't make sense to delay anymore? No, there's no ceiling like that. There's a ceiling based on your original earnings record having limits put on it, what got dropped into that earnings record each and every year as you earned maybe more than the wage cap each year. Now, if they were wondering because they'd like to figure out how much is their benefit maybe going to increase over the next 3 to 6 years, just watch for the annual cost of living adjustment announcements. Once you've reached 62 years old, your benefit goes up each and every year with the cost of living adjustment that gets announced each fall by Social Security. That applies to you, even if you're not collecting your benefit. So as you're delaying, not only are you getting delayed retirement credits, but you're also banking cost of living adjustments as well. Below age 62, you're getting a different type of adjustment than the cost of living adjustment, so my answer would be a little different for a younger person. But since both these spouses are 64 and 67, the only thing that's affecting them now is delayed retirement credits for him. The wife is 64, so below full retirement age, so her adjustments, she's not getting delayed retirement credits yet, but as she ages closer to a full retirement age, her benefit is not being reduced as it otherwise would if she were to claim today. And then once she hits 67, then she's going to start earning delayed retirement credits. Sounds like they're both going to wait to 70. I'm not going to judge that choice. could make perfect sense in their case. Maybe it's not the greatest in their case. I don't have any information to comment on you know, the strategy of both of them waiting to 70, but they both will get cost of living adjustments applied to their benefit as each and every year goes by from here on out. Before they're claiming, and then after they're claiming, they'll keep getting them as well. So I think I hopefully answered their question. The answer to the trivia question, which was, we live in a state has third longest coastline in all 50 states. The answer is, and I haven't checked this, California. Sounds reasonable, but if it's wrong, we have to blame the listener. I didn't look up the answer to begin with here. So, okay, question number 4. This one comes in from, let's see, this, they didn't do it, they indicated they're from Texas, but they didn't include a hint. I also don't have a date when this came in, but not that that matters a whole lot. Pretty short question here. Let me read through it. My husband retired at 62. We had twins, age 12 at the time. They are now 13. I am 58, and I work with over $100,000 a year in income. My kids each receive one half of my spouse's benefit amount, and they put in all caps benefit amount. I expected them to receive one half of my spouse's PIA. It just so happens that my spouse, collecting early, and two kids, age 12, collecting half of the PIA, was nearly exactly our family maximum. Why did Social Security only allow half of the benefit amount versus half of the PIA? Everything I read said they are to receive 50% of the PIA. Thanks. And they share their name. We'll call them Georgette. So another family maximum question. So we just happen to have two of these in the same show. In this case, I actually revealed the answer to this question as I was answering the previous question, but it kind of, I'm sure it slid by most people, if not everyone. The key to answering this one is how they apply the family maximum. His benefit, even though it's being reduced because he claimed at 62, before his full retirement age, that reduction is somewhere around 30%. When they calculate the family maximum, they don't use the benefit they're actually paying him. They use his PIA as the starting point. So that goes in. You're not getting a reduction of crediting against the family maximum because he claimed early. And you might say, well, that's unfair. It's just the way they do it. But on the flip side, you can benefit because if you delay to 70, when they calculate your family maximum, they still just use the PIA. So you can actually be collecting more than what gets credited into the family maximum. But it's just the rule of how they do it. His PIA is the first number that goes in. Then, as I mentioned before, another 50 to 82% of his benefit can be paid to other beneficiaries. Now, the general rule is exactly what this listener stated, or I'm not sure they're a listener because they sent it in through our website, but the children, when they qualify, a qualifying child can receive 50% of the PIA of the number holder. So she's right. The base expectation is 50%, and children don't pay a penalty for claiming, quote, early. They're children. There's no age limit for children. So it's not like they reduce it because they claimed earlier than some arbitrary age. So normally each child, and if only one child was receiving benefits, they would have gotten the full 50% of the PIA. But guess what? 50 plus 50 is 100%. And the maximum that you can be paid is about 82% of the husband's PIA. And I also said before, the way they reduce it, they don't pay the first child full. Let's pretend your family maximum was 75%. Technically, it's 175, but he counts the 100. His PIA eats up the 100. So the other beneficiaries have to share the 75. They don't pay the first child, like the oldest child, 50. Well, I guess they're twins. So, but the first child, 50%, and then the next child, 25%. They pay each child 37.5%. They take the 75 that could be paid and divide it by two. If there were three children, each child would get 25%, because they take the 75, that's the max they're allowed to pay out to the beneficiaries, these auxiliary beneficiaries, and divide it by three. If there was three of them in a child and care benefit, let's say she wasn't earning $100,000 a year. In this case, there's no reason for her to try to claim a child and care spousal benefit, because she's making so much the earnings record would destroy it. So it's good she hasn't claimed it, because she wouldn't get it anyway. But if she wasn't earning that, she would go into the pool as well, and they would split the maximum amount between the two twins and the spouse here. That's not going on here. But that is exactly why you're seeing the children, the kids, the two twins in this case, not getting 50% of the PIA. It's because you're using your husband's age 62 benefit towards the family max, and you can't. You have to use the PIA against it. That's the answer to your question. So hopefully that clarified things for you. The last question here I have, kind of a long one, but that's a lot of numbers. I'm not going to read through all these numbers, I can tell you right now, but this one came in just a couple months ago. It says, Jim, let's see if they gave us the answer to they gave us a trivia question, but they didn't give the answer that I see anywhere. I'm going to read the question so you all can be looking it up, but I have no idea what the answer is, but you can, maybe some of you know this. It says, my state was where the very first baseball game was played in the United States in 1846. I personally have no clue, but that's the question. I was looking at the Social Security COLA based on CPIW from 1975 to 2023, 49 years. My guess is they went back to 75 because that's the era of automatic cost of living adjustments. Prior to that time, there wasn't an automatic cost of living adjustment to Social Security. Congress had to proactively make adjustments, and they would do that kind of sporadically before they put it on autopilot, tying it to CPIW. So going back to his email, he looked at this to get a sense of what to expect over a long-term average across retirement. The average COLA, cost of living adjustment, and when I say COLA, which is probably going to come up a lot in this email, that's cost of living adjustment. The average COLA for 49 years is 3.77%. This, however, is biased from high inflation in the 1975 to 1982 period. That is true. There was inflation. There was cost of living adjustments in the early years as high as like 14, north of 14%. Being the VG, Vanguard engineer, that I am, I decided to look at 20 different 30-year periods, which is more relevant to us. So he has a nice little table here. That's why I said there's a bunch of numbers. So he essentially took a running 30-year periods. And so the first period runs from 1975 to 2004, then from 76 to 2005, 77 to 2006. He did this for like 20 different periods, all the way up to the most recent 30-year period from 1994 to 2023. And he observed, when looking at those 30-year periods with varying start years, that the average cost of living adjustment was as high as 4.5% on average for the very first 30-year period from 1975 to 2024. The average COLA, 4.5 over 30 years. That's how high inflation was during that period. The lowest looks to me like from 1991 to 2020, the average was 2.26%. And I will also comment, I'm not going to read every single one of these periods, but I will say ever since every single 30-year running period starting in 1983 until today has all been less than 3%. Highest was 288, and then it declines from there. The most recent 30-year period from 1994 to 2023 that he supplies, 2.54%. It's exactly, I trust these numbers. These are exactly, I didn't calculate these look exactly like what I've seen in my own calculations and looking at this over time, that for the past, 40 years, if we look at 30-year running periods since 1983, it's been less than what most people consider to be average inflation, less than 3%. Starting at 288 most recently, most of the numbers have been at 2.5 or less, average over a 30-year period. So getting back to his comments, as you can see, there are 30-year periods as low as 2.26% on average and as high as 4.5 for periods with an average, for different periods with an average of 30-year periods being 3.05. So essentially what it did is did an average of the 30-year averages. Being conservative, I plan on using a lower period number of 2.3% assumption in our average Social Security income COLA growth for planning purposes. I hear Chris commonly suggest that 2% is what he uses. That is significantly lower than any period in the last half century. What is the basis for this? Using 2.3% as a COLA with our minimum dignity floor inflating at 3.9%, with a retirement age at 66 and a delay period to age 70. If you don't know what all those things mean, that's some of the things we use in our planning process, like the minimum dignity floor, the delay period. Listen to our current ongoing EDU series where we're walking people through our process. If you're a new listener, you're not sure what those are, but longtime listeners will know exactly what they're talking about here. So to state again, using 2.3% as a COLA with our minimum dignity floor inflating at 3.9, a retirement age of 66, and a delay period to age 70, our reliable income goes negative around age 77, meaning they're facing a crossover point about age 77, which is in line with what you've suggested is common. Using Chris's 2% COLA, this is, of course, happens earlier in retirement. The crossover point in our description, that's when the minimum dignity floor is expected to start exceeding your secure income. He called it reliable income. We call it secure income. Secure income is things like Social Security, pension income, income annuities if you have them, regular recurring income that's going to come in no matter what, whether you have assets or not. We like to look to that type of income to cover the most important expenses in our eyes, the minimum dignity floor expenses. And he's clearly using some variation of our approach in his own calculations, but in his assumptions, in his planning assumptions, he's wondering why I use 2% for Social Security, and he's using where the data might suggest using something higher. Well, this comes down to planning approaches, how we like to stress plans, or how conservative do we want to be without tipping over into pessimistic or even more egregiously apocalyptic. I joke sometimes I can make any plan fail if I use apocalyptic assumptions. Our general approach is to remain solidly conservative without being overly pessimistic and certainly not getting into apocalyptic, because I think that's problematic at best. So let me explain where my 2% assumption comes from. We started observing exactly what his data is showing a number of years ago, where the average cost of living adjustments in recent times have been noticeably less than 3, between 2.5 and 3. And so for the longest time, we used 2.5, which was a little lower than the averages that we were seeing. And that was, in our eyes, was conservative. We didn't want to use the more common 3%. For some strange reason out there, planners, financial planners in the industry and a lot of the software tends to use the same inflation rate for expenses as they use for income that's cost of living adjustment. While academically they should be consistent, Social Security, the way they measure Social Security for or cost of living adjustments and apply it to Social Security, doesn't always map well against the expense inflation we see for retirees. And that's because CPIW doesn't, that basket of goods and services doesn't mimic most retirees' consumption basket. Not to get too, you know, econ terms on you or anything, but so we use 2.5%, and then, you know, most of our expenses, like this person, inflate faster than this. So we see expenses growing faster than the income, the Social Security income, which is just a byproduct of these different assumptions for inflation. But I'd say about, 6 years ago now or so, Jim and I, and more recently, everybody in the office, talk regularly about our planning assumptions. Have things changed in the world? Are we seeing something different? Are we learning things from our own clients that we've had from a long period of time where we should be using something else? Is there something wonky going on now in the Florida insurance market and we should be making different assumptions for inflation on homeowners insurance in Florida? Those of you in Florida know exactly what I'm talking about. Seeing different pressures on property taxes where we should be using different assumptions there? And the Social Security question comes up even to today. But 6-7 years ago, Jim and I were talking, and we pay attention to what's going on in Washington, D.C., because their decisions affect all of us, including retirees. I would say, I don't know. It feels, probably because we're in the retirement planning business, it just feels like a lot of the changes they make affect retirees more than the general population, but that's probably just my bias kicking in. Whether that's true or not, their decisions certainly affect retirees. And there's been chatter going on for the past almost decade now about adjustments needed for Social Security. And Social Security has an inflow-outflow problem. The inflow going into Social Security is less than the outflow. The only reason that Social Security can continue now to pay the benefits they're promising people is that they built up a cushion called the Social Security Trust Fund that's been being built up since the 1980s as we saw the baby boom wave heading towards retirement long, long ago. So there was more inflow than outflow happening for several decades, building up a large trust fund. But that trend has reversed with the baby boomers retiring and going on Social Security, and now the outflows are higher than the inflows. And the prediction is those outflows are going to cause the trust fund to expire in the early 2030s. So we're now approaching the 10-year mark or less of when that is going to happen. And by law, Social Security can't pay out more money than it has. So if the trust fund expires and no adjustments are made to Social Security benefits will be cut. This has been well known for a long period of time. Now, I personally don't see that happening. I think that's fairly apocalyptic, because for that to happen, no adjustments would have to be made over the coming 9 years or so. And I think the chances of nothing happening in the next 9 years on this issue is close to zero. But that's a conversation for another day. That could easily take a whole show, and it probably have other people you would want to just hear my opinion on this, but others. But for the cost of living adjustments, as part of these conversations that are bounced around in Washington, D.C. about adjustments to Social Security, there's proposals that include changing the way the cost of living adjustment works for Social Security. So some of those proposals might actually increase the cost of living adjustment a little bit. Well, that would be welcome news, and we would love that for retirees. That would be great. That would give them more secure income in the long term, help protect them from inflation. But some of the proposals would result in likely a reduction of the cost of living adjustment. So while we used to use 2.5% because it was justified by the historical data, we're always looking forward about how things might change. And Jim and I made the conscious decision to build in some protections against these proposals, or to acknowledge these proposals that might erode the cost of living adjustment a little bit. So if we take the 2.26 or 2.3 that this listener seems to say, you know, and I agree, the data supports him using 2.3, looking behind us. Looking forward, though, we're taking a similar view. Let's stay on the conservative side, but let's also throw in the assumption that the cost of living adjustment gets adjusted a little bit downward. That's where our 2% assumption comes from. I don't know that that's going to happen. I sure hope it's higher. And to be honest with you, there's a difference between what we build in for assumptions for our projections and what my best guess is that happens. Your best guess for most people, when we look statistical but guessing, you're going to guess about in the middle of the range of things that might happen. My best estimate, my best guess is it's going to be higher than 2%. I'm not saying I think it's going to be 2. I'm saying let's look at the numbers in case it's 2. A lot of the assumptions you make when you're planning, you don't want to use worst case scenarios. That's kind of that in every assumption. The chance that the worst case happens to each and every element of your retirement, that's when we get into a apocalyptic view and things aren't going to look good. But on the conservative end, certainly. And I think that's where our 2% comes from. And I think hopefully you agree that seems reasonable. If not, you can use something else in your planning. I'm not mandating that you do this. And I really have no problem with this person using 2.3. I think that's a perfectly reasonable assumption. I think, the reality is probably more like what he's assuming is probably more likely to happen than the 2%. But we're being conservative with the 2. That's where that comes from. So, well, that's the last question I've got. I guess we are close to an hour, so I thought that was where the show would be a little extra short today. But hopefully that enlightened some folks on these things. That one question, if that strategy the one representative was proposing, where you could cancel your Social Security disability right before it converted and escape this suspension hell you might get stuck in, where you wouldn't be able to do the claim survivor then switch strategy that other people can do, please let me know, because that would be a big one. But I suspect you can't undo it. Once you've gone down the SSDI path, this disability path, you've claimed until full retirement age. Even if they suspend your benefit because you go back to work, you're still in the system claiming effectively, and it's going to automatically convert to a retirement benefit at your full retirement age. You still could suspend, but there's that issue that I described when I answered the question. So if somebody discovers something new about that, please let me know. If you want to send in your own questions for future shows, just send them into Jim directly. jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. That's jim@jimhelps.com. We really appreciate the questions because that's what makes the show work. Make sure you put in the subject line of the email that it's a question for the podcast. It's also handy if you put kind of the general topic in there, like Social Security or IRAs or RMDs or taxes or, you know, whatever the question might be. That's kind of helpful when he's searching through his pile for each and every one of these shows. I know he'll be back next week for our shows, so this is just a one-time event, at least for the near future. Appreciate you listening to my lone voice droning on for an hour. And take care, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.